many people establish limited partnerships basically on an operating agreement and a handshake and a little bit of money. But I have found out that it is prudent and wise to always have a written agreement, because no matter what you agree to, years down the road, people remember what they want to, and it's always wise and prudent to put business matters in writing, signed by both parties.
And we're talking partnerships.
We're talking any type of business. Many times when companies are set up as a limited liability company, the tax person will say to them, you can file this as an S-corp, and you can. You can file this as a C-corp. If a limited liability company only has one member, it's going to be treated as a C-corp, so it's always important to have at least two members, a general member and a limited member. But both of those cannot be the same person. You actually need two individual people to hold those positions. But I prefer to have a 1065 tax filing, and that's basically a pass-through. It says after all deductions inside the limited liability company, you're going to receive your share, representative of the memberships that you hold, you'll receive your share of the profit, and it's much easier to control. And the other reason I like limited liability companies, unlike a C corporation really shouldn't have a limited liability company to be one of its stockholders or its president. But a limited liability company can have a C corporation as its general partner. So for asset protection purposes, I suggest that my client set up a shell general partnership that owns 1% of the general partnership of the limited liability company. And that corporation only owns a pad of paper and a pencil. So sue it. We don't care.
Let's say I'm operating my business. If I'm the general partner, I would be the C-Corp as that general partner, which is owned by the limited liability company?
No, it's the other way around. The C-Corporation would be the general partner that manages and controls the limited liability company. But it would only hold that position as maybe a 1% general partnership.
Who owns the other 99% of the partnership?
You could own the other 99%, because remember that the C-Corporation has a separate federal ID number and is a separate individual. So if it owns 1% general partnership and controls the limited liability company, you could own the other 99% and have absolutely no liability.
Okay, very interesting.
Yeah, it's an asset protection strategy that works quite well. But there has to be a viable business purpose for the C-Corporation to exist. A good example of that would be to have the general partnership be a management company that receives its share of the profits of the limited liability company in exchange for its management abilities. And that's a viable business interest.
And it doesn't own any assets.
So my favorite business entity is a limited liability company, because they've been proven to me to be simple enough that the average person can run them. Another advantage of a limited liability company is, unlike a C corporation, it doesn't really have to file annual minutes. Many times C corporations are penetrated and set aside in a lawsuit because the officers have not kept up with their annual meetings and they're not recorded, so it makes them very vulnerable to penetration, where a limited liability company is not required to actually hold those meetings on an annual basis. It's wise to do it if you've got more than two members. For example, if you're a limited liability company and you're a real estate investment company and you're buying and developing properties and you have 160 limited members, it would be wise to have things in writing. Next business structure that is available is a business trust. In the past few years, these have really come under attack by the IRS as being fraudulent trusts or abusive trusts. If you go on the IRS's website, you will see those warnings pasted there. But the truth of the matter is, those attacks were generated by people who set up business trusts and tried to deduct dog food as security expense. They were trying to deduct their own personal TVs and stereo equipment as audio-visual equipment of the business trust. But it's not an unknown entity.
Trusts are what, like, the Rothschilds and some of the richest people in the world have used.
Yes, in fact, the Fidelity Magellan Mutual Fund is a business trust. So is the Scudder Capital Growth Fund. So is Shell Oil Company, Lloyd's of London, London Stock Exchange, the Kennedys, Rockefellers, DuPont, Mellons, President Clinton, and Jimmy Carter have them.
They're all trusts.
They're all business trust. Now, do you remember when Hillary Clinton got into trouble because she had a conflict of interest when she was trying to install the national health care program? That conflict was brought about when someone discovered that she owned a large portion of her portfolio on Merck stock, and Merck is a big pharmaceutical company. Well, it just so happens that she came back about 4 days later, and they said that she no longer had a conflict of interest because she, Bill, and Chelsea had set up three blind trusts. Well, a blind trust is another name for a Massachusetts business trust that is basically a business trust. And one of the largest trust companies is American Timber Trust Company, and they've been around for almost 180 years. And have never been challenged because they're a business trust. So what I'm saying is, because of the inherent nature and attitude of the IRS, this may not be the proper entity for 99.9% of businesses. But there are particular individuals that control a large amount of wealth that may want to consider establishing a business trust and filing a 1041 with all the deductions that they're able to take, just like a corporation, and have some advantages that the average business structure doesn't have. However, it's going to take quite an experienced attorney to do this, and someone who's not afraid to go against the grain. 99% of the people don't need this type of problem, but it is a very advantageous entity if you understand it and know how to fight for its rights.
Now, how does this differ from a family trust, where people are setting up family trusts to protect themselves from probate issues?
Family trusts are a revocable trust. And by the way, I should discuss revocable and irrevocable at a later time, but revocable trust is basically saying, I own this asset, and this is just a quasi-me, but the difference is when I pass away, all the assets in my revocable living trust are going to pass outside of probate, and so there's not going to be a need for an 18-month settlement period or a 20-year settlement period. Trust or revocable living trust are also less likely to be contested, and there are just so many benefits, and once the assets pass out, they pass out by the contract. After all, a trust is a contract and is controlled by contract law, not statutory law. Probate process can end up costing the family 7 to 10% of the deceased estate, as well as a delay in time and a lot of aggravation, whereas most revocable living trusts are settled within 90 days to 6 months at one-tenth the cost of probating an estate.
Okay, well, we can talk more about that later, but that's really a separate issue from what we're talking.
Be not the same type of trust. This is a trust that actually operates as a business and has a federal ID number. The next thing that we need to discuss briefly, and this doesn't fit a lot of people, but foreign corporations or entities are something that some people want to consider, basically because they're getting a little tired of the confiscatory attitude of the IRS and the limitations and the penalties of law in the United States. So you're finding many companies that are outsourcing many of their jobs and programs and administrative costs that they used to have here in the United States to a foreign jurisdiction.
And you can legally do that. We're in a worldwide economy. You can set your business up anywhere in the world if you have the knowledge, right?
Absolutely, and there are reasons to do that. For example, you may want to outsource your shipping because it's cheaper, but you also are not required in other jurisdictions to comply with ERISA and make contributions to those employees' retirement programs. And so there are many advantages to doing that. Now, I think all people who work for you ought to have some type of retirement, but you're not as restricted as you are in the United States.
So we're talking foreign corporations and entities. What are some other advantages to setting up outside of the United States jurisdiction?
Well, basically, they're in a total different jurisdiction, and I try to use countries that are under common law. They actually operate their government the way we used to do back in the days of our forefathers, without all the statutory law, oversight, restrictions, and overseers of the government entities, such as OSHA, ERISA, and all those type of ABC entities. When I say ABC entities, I'm talking about governmental restrictive entities.
So what are some of those common law jurisdictions?
Some of those common law jurisdictions are the island of Nevis and a little country called Dominica. It's not Dominica, it's Dominica, which is right next door to St. Kitts, the Turks and Caicos Islands, the Bahamas. Those countries have basically given up their rights to the IRS and allowed the IRS to come in and look into those bank accounts and companies that used used to be totally private. In fact, some of those countries used to have laws, if you revealed any information about their corporations, you could be hung.
So there's people from all over the world searching for safe havens, countries with common law to set up and establish their business entities to operate in privacy.
Yeah, and the IRS propaganda is they're really tax evaders and they're looking for tax havens. But in reality, those people are looking for freedom. They're tired of government restrictions and losing their profits to a government.
There was a website put together by a bunch of accountants that lists all the SIC codes in the different industries. And I was just doing some research. I don't remember the actual URL. But you could look up an industry. So you could look up dentist. And then it'll give you all the stats that have been gathered by the government of the entities that the dentist had set their business up in. And I remember this specifically. I think 60% of all the dentists in the United States were sole proprietors.
Right. And it's so much easier for them to be set up as a PLLC, Professional Limited Liability Company. If you'll look around at many attorneys nowadays, they're operating under PLLCs. So are doctors. So are dentists. They have personal liability protection. So if we separate our wealth and our liability and our home into three different entities, and we have a car accident, can they sue the company that owns our home? No. It's a separate entity. So we'll never lose our home. Unless there's an accident on our home, of course, you want to carry $1 million umbrella policy and liability policy on that home, whatever company owns that or trust owns that home. So therefore, you can take care of anything that happens on the property, and the chances are you'll never lose your home. And you can't lose your wealth because it's set up similarly, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the advantages of multiple entities is asset protection and diversification. No longer do you have to hold all your assets into one bag. You know, if you got one hunting dog, to use a southern analogy, and that hunting dog gets sick and dies, you're not going to be able to hunt the rest of the season. That's why you want to have four or five bird dogs. Employer benefits. I've talked about this and hit upon it briefly earlier in our conversation, but if you have a separate company that you work for, that company can provide you many benefits, and that company's profits do not have to be shared with other employees because there's possibly no other employees in that company. You can be a general member and a limited member and also an employee. As long as you have another member to be involved in that limited liability company, you only have two people to worry about, and then you can use an age-weighted or compensation-weighted retirement program, and most of the benefits will go to you. Employee benefits, of course, can be separated. And one of the biggest liabilities that most companies have is human resource problems and lawsuits. So sometimes it's wise to have one company that hires and pays your employees that contracts with the company where your major wealth is being made.
So in my entity, I can separate my employees' benefits, my whole human resource department, as a separate company that will separate where all those lawsuits come from.
Absolutely. You can have National Widget Company that actually manufactures and makes a large amount of the profit. Then National Widget Company of California could be the company that actually hires and employees, your employees.
Kind of like the military has everything compartmentalized.
Yes, and you can play the same game. And one of the other advantages of multiple domiciles is that you can use a foreign LLC. For example, I could use a Nevada LLC. By the way, I do like Nevada, and I like New Jersey, and Alaska's come out with a new business trust that I really like in the past 5 years. But you could use an entity in another state, which is titled as a foreign jurisdiction, but it's not foreign, it's just in another state. And the problem with that, if I've got a business in Nevada and I want to do business in North Carolina or California, I'm going to have to pay an additional franchise fee for that company to operate legitimately in North Carolina under statutory law.
So you pay that franchise fee in North Carolina?
Right. I would have to pay it in North Carolina.
Why do you say a franchise fee?
Well, it's basically the right to operate in the state. Many times they call corporate fees, annual fees, franchise fees. It's not a franchise as a business.
What does something like that cost?
Well, in North Carolina, to have a foreign LLC do business in this state, the annual fee is about the same as it would be for domestic. They're not really saving any money. However, there's another ploy you could take here. You could say, okay, I have a Nevada LLC and I have a North Carolina or California LLC that's going to enter into a contractual relationship with a Nevada not a corporation to provide management fees or other administrative duties or some other administrative operation that the company needs, and we're going to remunerate that company out of the proceeds of our domestic company. So you could get the majority of your profit over to Nevada, where you don't have a state tax and you don't have many of the other taxes, and plus you've got much more privacy over there because Nevada really doesn't cooperate with the IRS on letting information loose.
They still hold pretty strong?
Yeah, they're still pretty tight on that. So basically their governor has said, go away. We don't want to talk to you.
How about Nevada corporations?
Nevada corporations are basically the same way. They have a lot of asset protection, but there again, you've got some double taxation problems with Nevada, so you got to make sure you understand that. And you can avoid paying that fee twice, so that's another wonderful thing. Now, if we continue on our little motto of remember to enjoy everything but own nothing, let's talk about judgment-proofing your life by having separate entities and multiple businesses. Let me give you a couple of examples. You could survive a lawsuit in one entity because it's really not connected to the other entity. It has a separate ID and PIN number, and as we discussed before, you can have a C-Corp to be the general partner of a limited liability company. You can also have a limited partnership and have probably superior asset protection in certain jurisdictions than you have in others. Now, you can frustrate creditors. We talked about that if you've got a plaintiff who's successful against you in a court of law, you can frustrate him by continually moving your business entities around. Have you ever seen a Hardee's or a McDonald's? They got a very successful location, and one day you drive by there and the place is boarded up and is closed.
Yeah, I have seen that.
And you drive two blocks down the road and there's a brand new McDonald's or a Hardee's.
What do you think that's all about?
Well, it's called bankruptcy. The location wasn't paying, so now they're just going to close it down, take a nice write-off, and the franchisee has moved to a new location under a new corporate or LLC name and can start depreciating that property all over again and write off his losses from the old location. Isn't that nice? So it's just another move to increase profits.
Well, I see. So if you do have a lawsuit against you and you get sued and you get a judgment against one of your entities, you can just claim bankruptcy. Will a bankruptcy protect you from a judgment?
Yes, if it's not filed after the fact, because you got to obey the badges of fraud. But generally, if there hasn't been a lawsuit filed, you pretty much can be safe moving assets. But if you know a judgment's coming and there has been any papers filed, it wouldn't be a good idea because you're going to be caught for fraud.
All right, so how are we going to frustrate creditors then?
We're going to frustrate creditors by having a limited liability company to restrict their ability to sue the company.
Like what we talked about earlier.
Right, but you can also frustrate creditors by going bankrupt before they come after you.
Gotcha. This is before it's actually filed. So you know when you're in trouble, and you could pre-plan that.
Yes, you can.
Legitimately and ethically.
Yeah, and there are ways to do that. Now, there are times to ante up and pay the freight if you're at fault. But the other side is you don't have to let a frivolous lawsuit ruin a lifetime's worth of work. You can also discourage predatory litigation, and we've talked about that. Now, I know some guys and business ladies who are very entrepreneurial, very well-meaning. They thought they had a good idea, and they went out and invested their life savings into a new business venture, and it wasn't successful, and they lost everything they had, and they had to file for bankruptcy. First of all, that didn't have to happen. How do you start over when you've been bankrupt? Many people say it's going to take you 7 years to regain your credit, and you're going to have to work hard to get your credit rating back up to where you'll be able to borrow money again. But the issue here is you don't have to worry about that. You can set up a limited liability company or a corporation and let it develop its own credit and start over in life, operate a business, and continue on.
That's exactly right.
It is wonderful because it's a separate person. It is not you. Now, if it comes to the point that the bank wants a signature guarantee on a loan or something, first of all, you're talking to the wrong people about loans. Banks are not where to go. It might be better to go out and find a private lender to lend you the money. If banks are charging 8% and you have to give a private lender 10% to rebuild your credit, that's a small price to pay for freedom and starting over again.
I like this. One of these entities is a solution for someone who has built a business under a sole proprietor and it has failed and filed bankruptcy. It doesn't mean it's the end. They could instantly, even after they file bankruptcy, start another business but under a corporation or LLC or one of the other entities we've talked about under a federal ID number, legally and ethically. Nothing wrong with that.
talking about being born again, the way to be born again. Let's talk about disability, because that falls along this same line. I know many military-type people who have become disabled and they're drawing the disability check or they're on Social Security disability, and they're under the assumption that they really can't make any more money than the $1,200 to $1,500 a month that they're getting. But that is not necessarily so, because their benefit is predicated upon earned income. Well, if they've got a business that they've invested in and they're getting income, a K-1 distribution from that business, that's not earned income, sir. That is passive income.
The distribution is passive income.
Right. So it will not disqualify them for their disability.
So they can invest as a limited partner in a limited liability company and earn passive income.
They could be a general partner and earn passive income. Isn't that wonderful?
The dividends from a general partnership, if they're the general partner, could be passive income?
Yeah, the distributions to the members of the LLC are not earned income unless they're on the payroll and receiving a 1040. They're only receiving passive income.
Go to the tax consequences on the difference between earned income and passive income. Let's say I earned $100,000 a year as passive income compared to earned income. Is there a benefit for me there?
Yes, because the earned income is going to be reported on your 1040 as wages or compensation, and the distributions are only return on investment, totally treated differently in the tax code.
Who pays more?
Generally, the individual pays more, because I'm not going to take those distributions in my own name. I'm going to have another entity receive those that's got internal expenses and costs to reduce the amount of those distributions.
And this is all another additional strategy and a benefit of having this set up properly.
Absolutely, and it's totally legal. I do not propose anything to my clients that are not supported by case law.
So for all those people out there who are retired taking disability, they really believe that they can't earn money because of this.
And it's not true.
And also, people who have been injured, disability is when you've been injured and you're getting payouts from that.
Right. So there's actually more freedom than we're brainwashed to believe in this country. And it's just a matter of knowing and understanding a uniform commercial code and knowing what your options are.
Yeah, and having the knowledge or knowing someone who has the knowledge.
And the experience. When I had the glass company, one of my employees returned a customer's car, it's actually a Toyota pickup truck, and plowed into a car full of people. And when the officers checked his blood, he was on cocaine. I had no idea I had a drug addict working for me. And I really lost a lot of money because I wasn't set up properly. Did I learn a lesson? And I went looking for solutions and had to educate myself, and that's why I picked up some of this knowledge. Now, we're talking about sexual harassment.
Is this common out there?
It is very common. If a woman's not promoted or a person of a different sexual persuasion is not promoted, many times they will come after you, basically claim that you harassed them or you were discriminatory against them because of their lifestyle. And many times these are frivolous lawsuits. Some of them are very justifiable and need to be handled appropriately and settled. But some of them are very frivolous and they're just basically a suit of revenge. Well, if you don't own anything, what are you worried about? It's very important to understand the concept of not owning but enjoying. Now, there's strategies for rental property owners. Let's talk about some of those. When people own property in their own name and rent it out, do you realize how much liability they're incurring? You got all kinds of problems. What if that property, unbeknownst to you before you bought it, was actually an environmental dump area and there's all types of poisons on the property? What if that property has been previously painted with lead paint and you've got a child picking at that paint and eating it? What if you have a rape upon that property? Are the renters going to claim that you didn't provide proper security? There's all types of crazy things that happen, and you need to protect yourself.
We're talking about people who want to buy a second piece of property and rent it out as an investment, whether it's one additional house.
Yeah, whether it's one additional house or a number of houses. I know people that start out buying houses at foreclosures and at option purchases and tax sales and tax lien sales and things of that nature, who start off with one piece of property and use the rental income to live off of for about 20 years, and then they go in and glean the equity off the property. Sell them and use it for their retirement. And they start out with one piece of property and they end up with 10, 15, or 20 properties.
All in their own name.
All in their own name. So one problem on one property could cause them to lose their entire life's assembly of wealth, including their own personal residence. So what I advise clients to do is, look, it's going to be too laborious to have 20 limited liability companies. But you could use a multiple LLC, and that's a little too complicated for our conversation this afternoon, but there are LLCs that have LLCs within them to own each separate property. But the cleanest way to do it is to set up a limited liability company that owns three properties. And every limited liability company is set up to own three properties. Therefore, if one limited liability company is sued, the worst that could happen if they're successful in their judgment is to claim three properties but not the other 17. And so you still got a base to rebuild from. Another strategy that I use is for property developers. Developers who are buying property, developing that property, and then building houses on that property and selling the housing with the lots. It's nice to have each of those stages in a separate limited liability company. The worst thing that could happen if you're buying raw land and having that land graded and prepared for housing sites and piping and plumbing and drainage systems put in is for someone to get killed upon that property during that process and destroy your whole future.
All right, so you're talking about putting the land in one entity and then the actual construction in another entity?
Yeah, have a development company, a construction company, and a sales company.
And you can do that?
Yes, you can do that. Another thing you want to do is make sure that you understand that separate entities are totally legal and that you have many advantages into separating your entities and your wealth from your liabilities. Another thing that's very big in my part of the country is trucking companies that do a lot of long-haul freight, short-term freight. You're talking about rigs that are in excess of $150,000, $180,000 that have huge interest on them. It's pretty cheap insurance to spend $125 to establish a limited liability company to own that one truck. If that truck has an accident, you're not going to lose your entire fleet.
Okay, I got you. If you're a trucking company, put each truck in a limited liability.
In a separate limited liability company.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, let's talk about how you can buy your home that you're living in at a 70% discount. Does that interest you?
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me.
Okay. If I work for a company, I can make an agreement with that company that, yes, I'll come to work for you, but in return, you're going to pay me $100,000 a year. You're going to pay for all my eyeglasses. You're going to pay for my dental and my health. You're going to provide me a golden handcuffs retirement program. You're going to provide me with a 401k and deferred compensation. These deals are made every day.
Yeah, with big corporations. I have a brother who just moved to England, and it was an international company, and that's exactly what they offered him, a place to live, a car, everything.
Right. It's done every day. And if a big company can do it, why can't a small company do it? The truth is they can. Without getting into all the details of the other ancillary benefits that I mentioned, let's just concentrate on the house for a moment.
All right. How do I get it at 70% off?
Okay. I have the house that's owned by a limited liability company. So it enters into a lease agreement with the company that I'm going to work for. Now, that house is worth $400,000, for example. I don't live in near that expensive a house. I'm sure that the house that I have here would probably cost $1 million where you live. But the lease on that house, the payments are actually running about $2,000 a month, but the company is willing to lease it to my prospective employer for $4,000 a month. So my prospective employer says, yes, we will provide you a place to live, but by the way, Gary, you got to pick up that $4,000 on your 1040. Okay, I have no problem with that, but why is that? Well, the IRS considers that compensation, and it has to be picked up on your 1040. Okay, so we're going to take $4,000 a month times 12 months, $4,000 a month times 12 months, which is $48,000. Well, what's my tax liability on the $48,000? Approximately 30 to 35%. So that company is buying the house for a 70% discount because my actual raw cost is only my tax liability. Isn't that unique?
That is pretty cool.
So now what kind of equity you have? You could even own the house in your own name and get a better deal. Or maybe not, because the limited liability company can do some depreciation schedules on company-owned property.
That is a great strategy.
So I just thought that would be a little tidbit that I could throw in there. Also, if you have a limited liability company and you need its cars, why do you want to buy a car in your own name when you can have a company that can go out and purchase fleet cars at a fleet discount? And that's done every day.
So how do you do that?
You go to the dealership and you say, I have a company. I need to buy a regular on-the-road vehicle, and we also need an SUV, and we need a truck.
And you get a fleet discount.
You get a fleet discount because the company's buying it. An individual's not buying it. And listen, if you're a company buying vehicles and you know that you're using those and you're going to be buying and selling, trading every 2 to 3 years, they're going to bend over backwards to make you a deal, especially especially in a buyer's market like we have today. So that's a very good benefit to having your own company.
I didn't get this home thing. Let's do the home thing again. Now, show me how I can buy a home at a huge 70% discount, but I want you to use me as an example or you as an example. Give me an example so I can follow along.
Okay. Michael, you created a company, and you want to go to work for that company.
I'm creating this company to protect my assets, right?
Well, for any reason.
All right, let's say I have an existing company right now.
You have an existing company, and they're looking for a manager.
Okay.
And you're available. Just because you're the general member of that company doesn't mean that you have to carry on the managerial administration, you understand. So they're looking for someone to come in and be a day-to-day manager.
My company is.
Yeah, your company is.
So let's say my company, JS&M Sales and Marketing.
Right. JS&M Sales and Marketing can hire you with the following agreement, that your company is going to provide you, their employee, a place to live, free eyeglasses. They're going to pay for your dental. They're going to pay you a golden handcuffs plan. They're going to provide you a deferred comp plan and a 401k plan. Make you an offer. So you say, yeah, I'll do that, only if you also throw in a place for me to live.
Okay, got it.
So what they do is now they're going to go out and look for a house to provide you to live in.
The limited liability, or if my company entity is going to buy the home to satisfy the agreement for the employee, which is me.
For your employment. That's right. Just so happens that an entity that likes you very well has a home for lease. Or you have a home that you're willing to lease to them that you own in your personal name.
Okay, so my existing home that I have in my personal name is willing to lease it to my limited liability company.
Right. So a lease agreement is actually drawn up and signed, a written agreement. Remember, I always do everything in writing and have it notarized and signed and witnessed if necessary. And so agreement is entered into where they lease the home to provide you a place to live.
Me and my family.
Right.
So I'm going to lease my existing home to my company.
Right. Well, it's actually not your company.
The entity.
Right. So that entity is going to provide you a place to live.
I got it.
You're going to go to work for them and do the things that you're probably already doing anyway, and you have a new employment agreement signed where they're going to provide you all this. So let's say the home is worth $400,000 or $500,000. The monthly payments on that home are about $2,000. So the lease agreement is entered into at $4,000 a month, and that's not excessive. If you look around in your area, $4,000 is probably common.
So the entity is going to pay $4,000 a month to lease the home to
right.
me.
But the entity lets you know that, hey, you know, Michael, this is a benefit. We've got to report this benefit on your 1040. So they're going to add an additional $4,000 a month or $48,000 a year to your 1040.
And that's going to go on my 1040, and what's that going to be claimed as?
That's going to be claimed as compensation.
Is it going to be claimed as, like, earned income in the same category?
It's taxable compensation or taxable earned income. That's right.
All right, so I'll be taxed on that $48,000.
Right. Let's look at the real situation here. That $48,000 represents a taxable transaction to you, but just because a tax may be due doesn't mean it has to be paid. It depends upon what other deductions you have personally on your 1040. If you're in the 30% bracket, you're probably going to pick up and have to pay a $12,000 to $15,000 tax bill, depending upon which bracket you're in. So what are you really paying for your house here? You're paying the tax liability. You're buying a $400,000 home for $12,000 to $15,000 a year. Pretty good deal, isn't it, buddy?
Yeah, how does the entity benefit, too, from a tax point of view?
Well, if you own the house in your personal name, your actual out-of-pocket is only your tax payment. But if it's the entity, then the entity, of course, is having the house paid for because of the spread in the lease agreement, and is also able to do depreciation upon that property. Of course, you got to remember, depreciation is always reclaimable upon sale of the property.
Excellent. I like that. And that's done all the time by companies.
It's done all the time by companies. In fact, many companies own leasing companies to set up these arrangements. You can accelerate your retirement plan by legally reducing the contributions to your employees' retirement plans by having separate entities that have employees and not. You can rent your employees. It's a big business nowadays called employee leasing. And you can have an unlimited tax-free retirement. And by that, I mean if you've got a separate corporation or a separate LLC and you're the only employee, can they not buy a huge key man life insurance policy on you? Sure they can. because if something happens to you, there's no business. So they could go out and buy a $5 million whole life plan that's got an internal tax buildup, and I know that gets against the common grade of buying term and investment difference. The problem is people buy the term, but they never invest in difference. But you could have that buildup, and that could be a variable life or something of that nature where you've got access to gains in the market. But the nice thing about a life insurance policy is all cash values can be loaned out income tax free. So if you had a $5 million policy that had $3.5 million in it when you got ready to retire in cash value, you could borrow out that $3.5 million, and all it's going to do is reduce your death benefit by the amount that you borrow out.
Yeah, it's just a loan. You don't pay any taxes
right.
on that.
You never have to pay it back either. This mm-hmm. is the insurable amount. So you have an unlimited tax free retirement. Now, you got to be careful because there are limitations upon what is just and compensated. Most of the time, they have a limit of $50,000 if it's a corporation, but we're not talking about a corporation. We're talking about a limited liability company that has a separate contract with an entity. And you can also have key man insurance on yourself, buy-sell agreements between you and your wife. So if there's a tragedy, if you're the general member and a limited member and she's a limited member, there could be a huge life settlement there if something tragic happened and really set your children up for life, for pennies on the dollar. And it's tax deductible by the entity if it's properly set up. So those are many of the ideas that I have today to share with you. I think we're probably on brain overload at this point.
This has been a lot of information, but I got it. I could definitely see the importance of this. I think everyone knows how important this is, but it's almost like when you're selling a preventative, people don't want to really think about these terrible things that can happen, but certainly they do, and the proper planning ahead of time is so important. What would you tell someone that doesn't want to face the reality how important this is? If you were to try and convince someone how important this is to properly plan this stuff and how you could solve this problem for them by doing all the hard work, I mean, is it going to be a pain in the butt for someone getting this set up, or is that what a professional financial planner, like with all your designations, does? Do you make it an easy process?
It is not necessarily an easy process to get it done. It is very easy to set up a limited liability company. It just takes money and some time and the proper structures and the proper documents. But the biggest problem I have with people is to get them to stop and think. I don't try to teach people a lesson or scare them. I just try to rattle the birdcage a little bit so they'll change their paradigm. Let me ask you a question. Is what you see really what you see? Is it real or is it an illusion? Is there a different way to think about this? Is it possible, just barely possible, that you could ever be sued? If you understand that what you see is not necessarily true or real, that it's an illusion because of the type of education, we're all told to go to work, go get us a college education, work real hard, get a job, and we'll be successful. But I know a lot of computer programs are looking for work. Computer programmers are a dime a dozen nowadays. But 10 years ago, that's where they were leading everybody to. It takes an unusual person with an unusual attitude to be successful in the world today. It doesn't come free. You have to work for it. And if you're going to spend your lifetime or the next few years amassing some money, doesn't it make sense to ensure your success? Now, you can go out and buy traditional insurance and do some of the traditional type planning, or you can learn to play chess by your rules. I would rather play in my front yard with my ball. And if you don't like my rules, then I'm going to take my ball in the house and you can go home. And that's the nice thing about properly structuring your business is that you write the rules. And you can protect your lifetime's work by taking a little time now to set up your business properly and to listen to some coaching and some guidance and establish the thing the way it should be the first time. For some reason in life, there's always time to do things right the second time around. But it is much more prudent, efficient, and effective to do it right the first time out. So let me ask you a question. If you're going to put all this effort into establishing a business, and that business becomes successful, are you willing to lose a lifetime's worth of work because you're too lazy to do the work on the front end? Now, I know that's hard talk, but you need to hear this. So my question is, if you're serious about protecting your future, then I am serious about helping. But if you're not concerned about it, and you're going to be like most people and turn over your stock portfolio to a broker to operate on in automatic pilot without any input or guidance from you because you want to go party instead of taking a couple hours a week and managing your money, then you deserve what you get. But if you want to have a successful investment experience, then you need to take control of your life and not farm it out. So yes, I'm going to ask you to do some hard work. But the other side of it is for your benefit. Anything worth having is worth working for. Life is like a garden. It's only successful if you work at it. And knowledge is not power. Knowledge applied with God's guidance is power. So my question is, are you serious about starting the right way, or do we go our separate way?
Very good. That's awesome. That's the interview with Gary C. I hope this has been helpful. And if you are interested in restructuring your business or you're thinking about starting a business and you'd like to email Gary about anything at all, please email Gary at hardtofindseminars.com. That's Gary at hardtofindseminars.com or call 858-274-7851. Gary has generously offered to do a 15-minute consultation to review your existing business structure and to offer all his best advice within that 15 minutes. I hope this has been helpful, and thank you. I started in the business buying and reselling hard-to-find seminars material. I had specialized in locating the very most expensive material, which was by a marketer named Jay Abraham. Well, I purchased from the original owners the original seminar material in the form of audio tapes, video tapes, books, and courses, and I resell them to people like you for pennies on the dollar. So someone may have paid $20,000 to attend a seminar and sit 5 days in an uncomfortable chair, but they all come home with the audio tapes. Well, I, from a personal need, didn't have the money, and I located hundreds of people who had these seminars, and I buy them and resell them to you. So what that means for you is you could get a $20,000 seminar for 10 to 20 cents on the dollar from me. If you go to hardtofindseminars.com, go to the product page and look for the section J. Abraham, and you'll see a multitude of seminars that I have available waiting for you. So if you want to take advantage and learn from the very best marketer in the world, Jay Abraham, and if you want to do it for a lot less money, head on over to hardtofindseminars.com, and I'm sure I'll have something that will fit your budget.